Fresh air, it's 25 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up at about 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Robert Shelton, a former New York Times music critic who's written a biography of Bob Dylan. With me now on Fresh Air is Derek Walcott, who many literary critics consider to be the most important Caribbean poet writing in English. Walcott was born and raised in the Windward Islands in St. Lucia in the Caribbean. The official language on the island is English, but many of the islanders speak a French Creole. Walcott is also a playwright. He founded and directed the Trinidad Theater Workshop, and in 1961 he won an award from the Jamaican government for his contributions to West Indian theater. Walcott has written about his conflicts with English. He loves the language, but not the colonialism that brought it to the islands. He's also written about his multiple identities as a black man from the islands who writes in English, feels ties to Africa, and also lives in Boston half of the year. He's taught in Boston at Harvard and Boston University. He now divides his time between Boston and Trinidad. Derek Walcott is in the Delaware Valley for two readings. He'll give a public reading this evening at 8 o'clock on the Bryn Mawr College campus in the Eli Room at Wyndham. It's free and open to the public. He'll also read tomorrow at 3 o'clock at the University of Pennsylvania, presented by the University of Pennsylvania Writing Program, and that will be at College Hall on the fourth floor. Derek Walcott, welcome to Fresh Air. Okay. And before we talk, I'd like to ask you to read a poem.
Right. Sabbaths, West Indies. Those villages stricken with the melancholia of Sunday, in all of whose ochre streets one dog is sleeping. Those volcanoes like ashen roses, or the incurable sore of poverty, around whose puckered mouth thin boys are selling yellow sulphur stone. The burnt banana leaves that used to dance, the river whose bed is made of broken bottles, the cocoa grove where a bird whose cry sounds green and yellow and in the lights under the leaves crested with orange flame has forgotten its flute, gommier peeling from sunburn still wrestling to escape the sea, the dead lizard turning blue as stone. Those rivers, threads of spittle that forgot the old music. That dry, brief esplanade under the drier sea almonds where the dry old men sat watching a white schooner stuck in the branches and playing draughts with the moving frigate birds. Those hillsides like broken pots. Those ferns that stamped their skeletons on the skin. And those roads that begin reciting their names at vespers, mention them and they will stop. Those crabs that were willing to let an epoch pass. Those herons like spinsters that doubted their reflections, inquiring, inquiring. Those nettles that waited. Those Sundays. Those Sundays when the lights at the road's end were on occasion. Those Sundays when my mother lay on her back. Those Sundays when the sisters gathered like white moths round their street lantern and cities passed us by on the horizon.
Thanks for reading that poem, and my guest is poet Derek Walcott. What's the language you first spoke? Did you grow up speaking English or more of a Creole?
Well, I grew up speaking both, actually, but my mother was a teacher, and it isn't that she discouraged the idea of talking French Creole in the house, but the environment of the house, she was a widow and she brought up three children, but the environment in our house was very strong in terms of its, you know, literary introduction to literature in terms of her teaching and the accessibility of a lot of very good books in the house. But around me and at school and around, you know, in the streets and so on, one spoke, you know, the other language, you know, which is French Creole.
So you were encouraged at home to speak more of English than Creole?
No, she didn't have an attitude about it. It's just that, you know, one was, you know, happy in both languages. So I did have, it's good, I think, for a poet to be able to have access to two languages.
Have you written in both languages a lot?
Yeah, well, recently I've been trying to, I have done some poems in French Creole. And recently I've been trying to do that again. But I think the difficulty there is if you, you know, it's an inflected sort of language. It's French. It has French roots, but it has African, you know, auxiliaries and, you know, derivations in it. So it's very hard to put it down phonetically and accurately. I prefer to use a French form of the word. There are people in the Caribbean who prefer to use a sort of, you know, they do the, what do you call it, the sound of the word is phonetic sort of speech. But it looks too coarse to me. I mean, it just looks, you know, it looks crude. I think that the delicacy of French Creole or Patois is when it has a stronger French, you know, French evidence in it. It tends to, if it's put down by academics or even by writers, just phonetically, it's, you know, it's very crude looking on the page. So I prefer to use the French root.
It sounds like the Creole is really more of a spoken than a written language.
I don't think there's a standard. I think in Haiti there may be a standardized form of writing the Creole. But these things vary. There's not, I think, a universal standardized pattern. I think they're trying to do that. But as I've said, I think that the tendency to reduce the language into purely its phonetic, mimetic look tends to lose a lot of the subtlety that's possible in the derivations in the French.
In your poem, Codicil, you wrote, "To change your language, you must change your life." Does that describe what you've had to go through?
Well, I think I meant more a matter of style rather than actual language, like French or Patois or English. I think in terms of a poet, a poet's changing, and poets do go through severe changes in terms of their own attitude to their work. And, you know, the two are inseparable. So that I think what I'm saying, and it's like an oblique derivation from Rilke, which is, you know, you must change your life, and something that James Wright also used, that the only way your style can be beneficially altered is if something radical also happens to, some change happens as well in your life. In other words, I don't think you can write in one way and live another.
Have you sought changes in your life in order to shake up your language and or in order to grow?
Well, I think
language?
Yes. I think that it does happen in some cases. I mean, sometimes it can be self-destructive. There are poets who might pursue, you know, in terms of imagination, in terms of keeping their inspiration going, might do it through drugs or might do it through alcohol or might do it through a sort of self-destructive process, you know, in which, in a sense, they're pursuing some kind of, you know, elevation of their imagination of some kind. It's obviously a very dangerous and a wrong track to go down. And then there's another kind of thing that can happen, which is to realize that poetry is a severely moral kind of occupation. In other words, you can have a life of misconduct, but at heart, every poet is a moralist.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think poets are driven by a severe sense of injustice, you know, of what's wrong. Their sense of irony is sharper, you know. Their apparent lack of responsibility to a system gets them into a lot of trouble, as it does in Russia or in any totalitarian society or, you know, any revolutionary kind of. After the flush of the revolution is over, poets are the ones who get into trouble.
You talk about poets having this keen sense of irony. I think one of the really apparent ironies in your life is that you've immersed yourself in the English language, but are very aware of the fact that English is a colonial language in the island you grew up in.
Well, I don't think of English itself as a... I try not, or have tried not to think of it too much as a sort of historical force. I think one of the dangers is to identify it as something belonging to the English, which it no longer does. It's the same process that America went through with the American writers, that they were speaking English, but they had to be American. It didn't mean that they abandoned English for some kind of Esperanto that they would invent for themselves. I think the whole question of identity, the English language is an empire. I mean, in terms of the width of its power and its, you know, the number of people who speak it. But that doesn't mean that it's the use of English makes one subservient to the idea of England, you know, because the great Irish writers could hardly be called Englishmen, and they use English.
My guest is poet Derek Walcott, who now divides his time between Boston and Trinidad, and he's in Philadelphia for a reading this evening at Bryn Mawr College and tomorrow afternoon at the University of Pennsylvania. You started traveling to America when?
I can't pin the date down. I used to make short visits way back, I think, like 58 or something. And then gradually I began to be invited to be poet in residence at different colleges. So I've lived and taught at Columbia, at Yale, at Harvard, you know, all over almost, in this side of the Atlantic, of the continent anyway.
What part of America or what cities specifically have you felt most comfortable in?
I got to like New York a lot. Now, I think you can't shut New York out. I think if you, no matter where you live, I mean, you know, you want some kind of peace, and it's outside the door, you know, growling, you know what I mean? So it's very difficult for me to think of living in New York now, but, I mean, I still love it to go there. I suppose that's the city I'm most attracted to in terms of the excitement of, you know, the variety and excitement, the usual thing about New York. But it is a grind to live there, I think.
Which reminds me, you have a poem about living in New York called Blues.
And oh, yes.
I'd like to ask you to read that.
Well, right.
It's on page 111.
Okay. This happened, this is an incident that happened when I was living in Greenwich Village and I got beaten up one night. And I remember after that happened, I called Frank O'Hara, an American poet, and I was very bitter about the experience. And he said, well, the same thing had happened to him. It wasn't a racial experience. It was just, you know, a bunch of young guys, you know, beat up anybody. But it's called Blues for obvious reasons, I think, that you'll hear in the poem. And it is based on an actual incident. Those five or six young guys hunched on the stoop that oven-hot summer night whistled me over, nice and friendly. So I stopped, McDougal and Christopher Street in chains of light. A summer festival or some saints. I wasn't too far from home, but not too bright for a nigger and not too dark. I figured we were all one, WAP, nigger, Jew. Besides, this wasn't Central Park. I'm coming on too strong. You figure right, there'd be this yellow nigger, black and blue. Yeah, during all this scared, in case one used a knife, I hung my olive green, just-bought sports coat on a fire plug. I did nothing. They fought each other, really. Life gives them a few kicks, that's all. The spades, the spicks. My face smashed in, my bloody mug pouring, my olive branch jacket saved from cuts and tears. I crawled four flights upstairs. Sprawled in the gutter, I remember a few watchers waved loudly and one kid's mother shouting like, Jackie or Terry, now that's enough. It's nothing really. They don't get enough love. You know they wouldn't kill you, just playing rough like young America will. Still, it taught me something about love. If it's so tough, forget it.
That's a great poem.
Thank you.
I know Frank O'Hara said that it really wasn't a racial incident, that you know, everybody gets beat up in New York. But were you prepared for the experience, though, of being a black man in America, you know, on the mainland?
No, actually, it gets very tiring because I've just come back from the Caribbean, and every time I approach America, I think, all right, I've got to make an adjustment. And it is an inferior adjustment to, you know, your normal life because you really go down one. I don't do the step down, but I just condition myself to the idea that, all right, so here's going to be your definition and whatever comes with the definition. It gives you a good sense of distance you can look on. I don't go through anything that is particularly, you know, disturbing, but, you know, there's so many things you see on television, some of those very dated jokes. I mean, when I come back and turn on the TV, you know, very soon in some program, if there's a black guy on or a black woman on, there's going to be some little joke. And I just turn it off because it's just very tiring. And it's really very inferior, you know, the kind of humor. I'm not saying that I'm not against jokes or even ethnic jokes. It's just that it's, you know, it's boring, really.
Do you think your language has changed from living half the time in the States and from being exposed to, different usages of English and different dialects from all the different ethnic groups that live in the cities you've lived in?
I think it's very hard to become American. It's hard for an American to become American. So it's even harder for people from outside to feel what this country means. You can only feel it, I think, in fragments, in part. I mean, it's very different. You know, California is very, very different. To live in, I mean, it takes a New Yorker it's very hard for a New Yorker to adapt to Los Angeles. Very difficult. So, you know, wherever an immigrant may come in, whatever city he may come into, he has the immediacy of his environment, you know, to try and understand. So this whole country, I think, consists of a bunch of people trying to understand the immediate neighborhood, and that takes, you know, generations to happen. Of course, what is great about this place is that you can pick up one morning and decide, well, I think I'll go to Philadelphia and live there, or I'll go to California, or I'll go to New Mexico. You know, it's a terrific sense of freedom and choice. You know, that's very exhilarating, the idea of it. But as in terms of being influenced by being in America, I think I don't know what I've absorbed. I find that I just come back from the Caribbean. I find, well, you know, I'm going to Boston and I'm going home. And that's, you know, that's a little startling to me, a little surprising, because I have lived in Boston now for 4 or 5 years. I do have a place there. And I'm going back to my job and stuff like that. I've been lucky in terms of being able to balance both things, you know. But I don't want to sound fatuous or over grateful, but a lot of things have happened to me through the, you know, through grants and foundations and, you know, I mean, even reading at Bryn Mawr, for instance, and getting paid for doing a reading like that, it's not the sort of thing that happens at home, you know. So there is, while one can knock America for a lot of things, I think in the universities, I think there is recognition in terms of some kind of merit of your work, you know. And what one talks about really is monetary, in the sense that you do get, if you want to say, rewarded, you know, for what you do. And Americans have a very direct and clear line about what money means. I don't think they're venerated to the extent that people think. I think they say, you know, okay, that's what this is worth. Okay, that's, the British don't do that. The British are always hedging and saying, well, you know, for instance, I've been invited to London often to do something, and they always say, if you happen to be in the area, they never mention the airfare, do you know what I mean? Whereas an American will tell you, are you available for X or Y, do you know?
You know, I think to a lot of Americans, the Caribbean islands are places to go vacation, have a honeymoon, or go down in the winter for a couple of weeks and warm up. What do you think when you watch all of the, you know, come back to Jamaica type ads on TV? You were talking about some of the stereotyping.
Well,
on TV.
I just came back from a hotel, so I am a tourist when I go down now. I don't have a house there.
You don't have a house anymore?
No, but I am. So I am a tourist, you know. I have nothing. I used to have, you know, hostility towards tourism until I, you know, gradually realized that everywhere sells itself, including England, you know, there's Shakespeare and Cotswolds, you know what I mean? Greece sells itself. Now, you can say it sells itself in the sense that it could be, you know, some kind of venal prostitution or geographic prostitution of some kind, but I don't think so. I think that, you know, people exchange populations, you know. I think that there was a time when there was a risk of, and as there is in the Virgin Islands still, where if you give too much leeway to, you know, if you give to the tourist, especially if Americans, for instance, are in the Virgin Islands, sometimes their conduct there can be as dangerous as it used to be, say, with the British, because, you know, a sense of ownership, this is ours, you know, and carrying over values that may be coarsened because they've lived in cities, and then treating people who are gentle and want to help, you know, as if they were their servants. I've seen that happen. But I think people in the West Indies have become very guarded about that kind of attitude.
I'd like to ask you to read another poem, and if you could, if you would read A Far Cry from Africa.
Right.
My guest is poet Derek Walcott, and he'll be reading at Bryn Mawr College tonight and at the University of Pennsylvania tomorrow afternoon.
This is a poem written over 20 years ago about the Mau Mau rebellion in Kenya. A far cry from Africa. A wind is ruffling the tawny pelt of Africa. Kikuyu, quick as flies, batten upon the bloodstreams of the veldt. Corpses are scattered through a paradise. Only the worm, kernel of carrion, cries, waste no compassion on these separate dead. Statistics justify, and scholars seize the salience of colonial policy. What is that to the white child hacked in bed, to savages expendable as Jews? Threshed out by beaters, the long rushes break in a white dust of ibises whose cries have wheeled since civilization's dawn from the parched river or beast-teeming plain. The violence of beast on beast is read as natural law, but upright man seeks his divinity by inflicting pain. Delirious as these worried beasts, his wars dance to the tightened carcass of a drum, while he calls courage still that native dread of the white peace contracted by the dead. Again, brutish necessity wipes its hands upon the napkin of a dirty cause. Again, a waste of our compassion, as with Spain, the gorilla wrestles with the Superman. I who am poisoned with the blood of both, where shall I turn divided to the vein? I who have cursed the drunken officer of British rule, how choose between this Africa and the English tongue I love? Betray them both or give back what they give? How can I face such slaughter and be cool? How can I turn from Africa and live?
Do you still feel like you face similar dilemmas to the one you expressed in that poem?
Yes, because ultimately I don't think the poet, however pretentious it may sound, is interested either in racial conflict or religious conflict. I think he's interested in something deeper than that, in the stupidity of man, in the horror of what man can inflict on his brother and so on. And it's not just cynicism. Certainly I think that elements in this poem would apply to South Africa, the situation in South Africa now. And then you understand the elements of revenge that drive people to the point, you know, almost like terrorism, you know, where if people aren't going to listen in a particular way around a green bear's table or because they have no armaments, then they have to resort to the most frightening and effective means. And the same thing happens in terms of, I mean, the horror of what might happen in South Africa. It's incredible that people cannot, you know, from previous knowledge, not see what is coming, in which, you know, the South African blacks are going to say, it doesn't matter now, you know, what happens to us. And the only way that the other side can hear is if so much horror is done that, you know, one horror lessens the other and amplifies the reaction of the other. And I think it's the same quality here, do you know?
You've written a lot of poems very descriptive about the island
that
you grew up in. Do you find that you write poems about your home when you're there or when you're away?
I've considered myself spiritually to have lived in only one island, St. Lucia. And I would have thought that, you know, all my life I've written about one island, which is 23 square miles long and 14 wide. And every time I go back, I find myself renewed by something else about it. I've begun to think, too, that there's not that any poet anywhere doesn't have a circumference beyond 23 miles of his immediate position, right? That it doesn't matter whether it's Hardy or Yeats or Joyce or whoever it is, or Homer or someone. As far as the eye can see in the horizon, in a 360-degree turn is your territory. It doesn't matter where you are. So, I mean, to inhabit one island and to try to understand it is, to me, not to waste a life on a small place.
Did you feel isolated, though, when you were growing up there, knowing that it was so small?
No, I felt continual wonder about the beauty of the place, because it's an astonishingly beautiful place, you know, and it's refreshing to go back there.
I want to thank you very much for being with us and also for reading some of your poems for
us.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
My guest has been poet and playwright Derek Walcott, who now lives half of the time in Trinidad and half the time in Boston. He's in Philadelphia for a couple of readings. Tonight he'll read at the Bryn Mawr College campus at 8 o'clock in the Eli Room at Wyndham. It is free and open to the public. He'll also read tomorrow at 3 o'clock at the University of Pennsylvania, presented by the University of Pennsylvania Writing Program. And that will be at College Hall on the fourth floor, again at 3 o'clock. The first reading is tonight at 8 at Bryn Mawr College. It's 2 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a couple of minutes on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by former New York Times music critic Robert Shelton, the author of a new book about Bob Dylan. The book is called No Direction Home, and it comes from one of the lines in Dylan's song, Like a Rolling Stone.
Time you dress so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. So loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounged.